Welcome to the Merlin Podcast, bringing Europe's fresh waters back to life.
This is a podcast telling stories about how the restoration of rivers, lakes and wetlands gets done in practice across Europe. We'll hear about dam removal in the Basque Country, floodplain restoration in Scotland, and wildflower planting along urban rivers that have acted as open sewers for decades in Germany. We'll also hear a story from Bosnia about the vital role of communicating with other stakeholders in a restoration landscape, and what happens when things go wrong. But perhaps paradoxically, we'll start with an American voice. Josh Wright is a conservation scientist working for the Nature Conservancy in the USA. Josh has led ambitious river restoration projects across Maine and is now an advisor to the EU Merlin Project. I wanted to get Josh's perspective on freshwater restoration in Europe and the work the Merlin Project is doing to help bring its rivers, streams and wetlands back to life. I'm Rob St. John and you're listening to the Merlin Podcast. Here's Josh.
So the time is crucial. We have great ambitions in Europe, and now the question is, how can we scale up for this to happen, to meet our objectives for freshwater restoration, peatlands and headwaters and main stem rivers? And that is exactly what the purpose of the Merlin Project is for, is to look at how we can scale up, do better restoration, create better enabling conditions, and maybe provide a better pathway forward. Yeah, it does start with a lot of great successes, incredible expertise brought to bear from quantified modeling that goes into extraordinary detail with the existing data, to community outreach and awareness building. And I've seen projects that have blown my mind as far as engaging with communities to develop restoration from that level up, compared to coming in and let's say a sort of famous example in Europe with the Saloon River and the government saying, no, these dams have to come out and we know how to do it, and thank you for your input, we're doing it. And how that does work in some places and doesn't in other ways. Is that going to be a good bellwether for more work in France? Probably not. But there are other projects developed with communities, with their concerns taken into account, with enough time for the process and relationships to build, to have really successful projects that will scale up, that will allow you to grow. We're seeing some case studies just take off and do great work in terms of restoring floodplains, in terms of restoring flow, and also connecting to communities along the way. It's brilliant. Some, predictably, have stalled, and this is always the case with restoration. It's extremely complex. There are always more facets to the problem than you might imagine at first. And it's wonderful to see the challenges ahead are being addressed head on by Merlin. Where are the places where we know we need to learn more? Where are places where we know that we need to help communities scale up to find out what they don't know in terms of where do we work, how do we work there, and where are we going to get the money to do this? I think it's looking at the mechanisms that are needed, and that may be stressful for member states as they try to meet these goals, as they really strive to do what's right for their rivers and the people around those rivers. I think we're going to have stumbling blocks and we're going to learn. And the more we have these opportunities to share successfully among successes and sharing failures, I think the better learning we'll have, the more this work will be second nature in another 5-10 years. So well beyond the Merlin projects, I think the impacts are going to reverberate through policy, through data, through the science around prioritization, through education and implementation of these projects.
Josh emphasizes that freshwater restoration is so often a slow and complex process, but also has radical potential in helping support both human and natural systems.
You could look at a dam removal project or a floodplain rewetting or a bog rewetting, and it seems like a very simple thing. There's just a mechanism, let water in, take water out. For all these systems, it's the process of managing water is crucial. And for all the wetland creation projects that failed, 90% of them are for lack of understanding of the hydrology and how to keep the water there. And then you layer on top of that a very changing climate, longer droughts, longer floods, the intervals in between, the severity, it's crazy. It's more than any human society has dealt with in our evolutionary history, let alone the fact that we're just understanding the complexity of ecosystems and socio-ecological systems, such that what we're doing with the ecosystem and how it's changing is at the same time being influenced by people and vice versa. And we hope that through this process that some of the vice versa part is that the restoring nature and improves people's lives. It makes more beautiful places for them to live, which makes their lives happier, that makes their stress levels lower. And I think we have the power to do this at the same time. So the question is, how do we prove that we may be able to have these benefits, and that'll be tricky, we'll learn together, but the ultimate objective is that your ecosystems are healthier, your fish populations, your birds, and your lives are better because you have this wonderful place that's vibrant and healthy and robust, and is gonna be a lot better at withstanding these crazy changes happening. So if we just make it barely survive and we're gardening this little ecosystem, it's not gonna be able to take a big whack in the head when the next rain wipes things out, or drought, or fire. But if it's a very robust system with lots of redundancies, with lots of area, with lots of native species and people looking after its systems to take care of it, I think we'll be much ready to move forward in a positive way and have that virtuous cycle of people helping nature and vice versa.
I asked Josh about how freshwater restoration in Europe compares to that in the USA. He emphasizes the importance of sharing lessons, stories, and inspiration from projects across the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's such an interesting seesaw. I've heard many people say how they've been inspired for river restoration because of the work done in the U.S., which started, you know, in the late 90s. There was some of the first sort of government-instituted dam removals in the state of Maine, where I'm from. And we've done some great restoration projects, and what I find is interesting is you come here and people say, oh, we want to learn from the Americans, and you've got a movement, and it's exciting, and you're getting things done. But then when you look at it a few years later, there are way more dams being taken out in Basque Country, in Finland, in France, and now in Latvia and Estonia and Lithuania. It's fantastic. So I think we're all learning at the same time, and I'm sure this project can help us all learn better from each other at the same time as we bring different languages and experiences together and different climates that we're working in and different cultural situations. I'm hoping there's a bit of a pendulum swing all over the place, and that we'll all recognize, especially with the severity of what's happening to the planet's climate, not just that we need to fight climate change, but this biodiversity crisis is also something that we can solve and that benefits us. And it's not a right-wing or a left-wing problem. This is for humanity. It's for an ecosystem. There's no planet B. This is it.
It's great to hear Josh's positive perspective on freshwater restoration in Europe, even as we face significant challenges from the climate emergency and political U-turns in making restoration projects happen. Over the last year or so, I've been following a fascinating restoration story from the Basque Country, which demonstrates the complexity of such projects, as highlighted by Josh. Arturo Elisegui and colleagues from the University of the Basque Country have been working to remove a series of dams and obstacles on the Deba River in order to allow natural water flows and fish migration to return. However, this work, supported by the Merlin Project, has itself met a series of obstacles. Here's Arturo to tell a story.
Well, the Deba River was the most polluted river in the Basque Country since 20 to 15 years ago, when the water agency, the Basque Water Agency, and the province government started to implement the sanitation and the wastewater treatment plants. So slowly, but life returned to the river. So now we have fish, we have kingfishers, every sort of biodiversity. But when you improve water quality, then you realize you have other problems. So among these other problems is especially the physical habitat. The river is totally canalized or channelized. And there are many small weirs or dams, which some of them are active, some of them are used for hydropower, but most of them are ancient, obsolete, not active anymore. They were built maybe in the Middle Ages for a mill, which disappeared centuries ago, or for an iron foundry, and so on. So there are 10 of these dams in the main stem of the Deva River, and our idea was to remove all of them. And this is something we are doing with the province government of Gipuzkoa, which is the implementation manager. They have been removing dams. I would say they are among the most active agents in dam removal in Spain, of course, and I would say in Europe as well. But initially, their focus was on the Natura 2000 sites, on salmon and so on. And so they did this river permeabilization plan some 10 to 15 years ago. They inventoried all the dams in the province, which were almost 1,000. Gipuzkoa is the smallest province in Spain, so it's a very high density. And they started removing them. Initially, it was like an extremely complex and difficult thing, and now they are doing it more routinely. But over the years, they have removed like over 100 dams from these 900 or almost 1,000 originally present. So when Merlin contacted us, it was we saw it like a big opportunity to make it more intensively, and especially to focus one of the rivers which was so far neglected regarding physical habitat. So we started contacting the local stakeholders at all levels, from schools, of course, the city councils, the Basque Water Agency, the all sort of stakeholders. In the Basque Country, I would say that we have a very local perspective, so we know each other in each valley. And in this case, it's easy to contact them. And initially, we started asking the stakeholders what was their perception of the river. And they insisted, of course, that pollution is still an issue, it's not totally solved. We are in the process. The second problem they perceived was floods, which are a problem. But most people thought that the dams were good against floods, that they regulate the flow, which is not the case of these small bays or dams, because they just raise the water level.
Arturo and his colleagues found themselves in a situation where some local people felt that the dams not only protected their communities from flooding, but they were also part of the region's aesthetic and cultural heritage.
So when we explained them that the reality was the reverse, that they were increasing the risk of flooding, most of these locals immediately understood and understood that what we were planning to do in Merlin was good. So in the first year of Merlin, we removed four from these 10 dams, with, I would say, no contestation at all. Then we have six remaining, and there we have like two problems, especially in one town, which is Soraluce, where they have three dams downtown. And we did the same thing. We talked to them, explained this is a town where they have quite a high risk of flooding. And we explained them that by reducing these, by taking out these dams, they would reduce flooding risk. And many people understood it, but there was some a small group of opponents, which were actually it's a group of people who are well prepared, are engineers and so on, who are already retired, but who have a lot of time and a very strong involvement. So we have had quite a lot of discussion with them. Eventually, we learned that the only thing they care is the aesthetics of the river. They like this stagnant water and the waterfall. And then they rationalize everything to justify their thing. And this is one of the problems. And the other problem is the Department of Culture of the Basque government. So, some of these dams were declared as cultural heritage by the municipalities. And at one point, the Department of Culture of the Basque government decided that they were accepting this protection. And when the municipalities declared them protected, the intention was to leave some. When we go to one of these protected veirs, we don't usually remove it totally. We leave the margins or something, some remnant. So we reduce flooding risk, but there is still some remnant of the cultural heritage. And so that was the idea of the municipalities when they protected them. Indeed, from the first day they wanted to remove the dams or part of the dams. But at this point, the Basque government thought, no, you cannot touch them. They are protected, and we are protecting them not just for the dam, but it's also for the stagnant water and the waterfall and so on. So we had this two problems or two fights. Regarding the locals, we had lots of meetings with them, but we couldn't reach an agreement. These opponents were demanding to make a referendum at the municipal level, and in a town where there are like 2,500 inhabitants, they got over 600 signatures in favor of this referendum. Of course, people who sing for a referendum are not all of them against the, removing the dams. But the politicians, they didn't want to make a referendum. In Spain, we have had quite bad experiences with referendums.
Arturo and his team reached an impasse. For all their arguments showing how dam removal would boost the health and diversity of the river ecosystem, opponents of the work had effectively stalled progress. But through a series of workshops, dialogues, and debates, stakeholders around the river continued to meet to discuss what could be done.
And so instead they organized one of these public consultation campaigns. And they hired a journalist, but he's a person who knows very well rivers and river restoration and so on. And so they organized several workshops, public workshops, with the journalist. And it was really good because the journalist started, okay, we are not discussing whether dams are good or bad for the river. We know they are bad. So we are not here, we don't accept negationism. They are bad for the river, but they are good for some other purposes and they can have some other values. And so after, I believe it was like five workshops, the municipal council, the city council, held a meeting where they voted, and in unanimously they decided that to support a report, a very short report they did. So the first point is dams are bad for the river. Second is some of the dams are used for hydropower production and so on. There is some are not used, but even among those which are not used, some are important for some people because they give character to the town and so on. So what we are discussing is, at the municipal level, is which is the importance we give to this character, to this landscape, versus the ecological damage they are doing and versus the flooding risk they are causing. Indeed, in this town, the urban planning is limited by these dams. If you reduce these dams, you can build more areas, which because they would cease to be flood prone. And this is important, especially for young people living in the town. And so in this town, there are four dams. One of them is very tiny and no one likes it, so they agreed to remove it. And from these three remaining downtown, the municipality said, okay, the uppermost, we are in favor of removing it. Well, it's partial removal, we are going to remove only one half. In the lowermost dam, the opponent said that our plan, the Merlin plan, and the plan of the Basque Water Agency were different, which they really were not, but they found some tiny differences in the description of works to do. And so the municipality said, okay, let's see which is the difference. Let's see whether the province government and the Basque Water Agency agree. If they agree, let's remove this dam and let's look how it changes. And after that, then the last remaining dam, the one which has the waterfall just in downtown, in which is the central, the focal dam for them, then we will take this decision.
So, after a long process of discussion and negotiation, it looks like the remaining dams will be removed in the future. I asked Arturo what he's learned from this process.
I would say the big lesson is that you have to take in account the opinion of people, of lay persons. They know a lot. Often the interpretation they do of what they know, it's wrong, and then you have to get to the ground and explain them why and why not. Use the what they can teach you. And yeah, that's it. That is not just a technical issue. How can we solve that? It's also a sociological issue and emotional issue as well.
This last point is important. Through Arturo's story, we're reminded that freshwater restoration isn't only a technical or scientific process. It directly relates to the stories we tell about what a landscape should look like, how it works, and how people use it. In this case, despite the significant ecological benefits dam removal could bring to the river, the process challenged deeply held narratives over the aesthetic and cultural heritage of the region amongst some people. And it's only through slow, patient dialogue with people with different viewpoints that the project and the river is beginning to flow freely again. For our next story, we move northwards to Scotland to speak to Charlotte Neary from the Forth Rivers Trust. Charlotte and her colleagues are using so-called nature-based solutions, restoration approaches that boost natural processes to help benefit both people and nature, to help tackle flooding along the catchment of the Forth River.
We're really delivering on two rivers, the Allan Water and the River Devon, which are split either side of the Ockle Hills. On the Allan Water, we've been doing some natural flood management techniques to boost biodiversity, but also slow the flow. So nature-based solutions to flooding, which hasn't really been it's not widely considered as a mainstream option in Scotland at the moment, but people are starting to think about it. So it's great that we have an opportunity to do this in the Forth catchment and then show what we're doing to other people. Some of the main interventions, we've installed 10 leaky dams on the Allan Water. So they're all on the little burns that are feeding into the main stem of the Allan Water, right in the upper catchment. It's a large amount of timber, almost like a tree log, basically, the main trunk of a tree. And you may have one or two or three of those over the river so that there's a gap underneath. But the logs themselves should never go above the height of the riverbank itself, because you don't want the water to hit it and then go around the outside and just feed back into the river really quickly. And you don't want them to be working all the time. You only want them to work at peak flow. So the water comes rushing down the little stream at peak flow. It'll hit the logs and that'll hold it back a bit. And sometimes if you've picked the right location, it will spill out and then go off down another field and add to a wetland. The thing about leaky dams is they're sort of an interim. I like to think of them as an interim solution. Because in Scotland, we haven't got much riparian tree cover, and we're frantically planting. And maybe by about 2050, those trees will be mature, and they'll start parts of them will start falling off or falling into the river, and they'll create natural leaky dams, or beavers will come and nibble the trees and bits will fall off and they'll create the natural leaky dams. But because we don't have those trees, we're putting these leaky dams in and as the interim to fill the gap until those trees are mature.
So in essence, Charlotte and her team are seeking to replicate the effects on the river that have been lost due to historical forest clearance and the local extinction of beavers. This work has been limited by prevailing weather and the need to minimise disturbance to local biodiversity.
A lot of this work needs to be done out with the bird nesting season, and we are working in a SSSI and a Ramsar, near a SSSI, near a Ramsar site, near an SPA. So we definitely have to, and that's all for birds, roosting geese. So we have to be out of the time window for the geese roosting. So really, we can only really deliver it between November and March. So we've got a small time window, and of course that's when you're going to have terrible weather. But we were really lucky that it didn't get too treacherous. And we have had three storms, but our diggers were not on site when the storms happened. But we did have a few weeks of absolutely freezing conditions. And the diggers, they're all diesel, and they were struggling to get started. So they came on site and it'd be at 6 a.m. They always start really early, contractors, for some reason. I guess they have it's dark by 3:30 or 4 in Scotland, so they only have a small amount of time, so they like to start early. But of course it was -8 and they couldn't get the diggers started, so that was a little bit frustrating. But I was so impressed with our contractors that they were, you know, they really persisted and they did things to help that scenario, and they just got going and carried on working, so we overcame that quite quickly.
As Charlotte outlines, this story highlights the often underappreciated role of skilled and sympathetic contractors in helping carry out restoration projects.
There's a little bit of a gap in the amount of people that can deliver this restoration work, especially if we want to upscale it to the levels we're dreaming of in 2050. Employing new contractors or training new contractors and being with them on site and guiding them is really important. And actually, in this project, in the green loaning part of this project, we've brought a brand new contractor in. We weren't expecting, but he put an amazing tender in, and he was a really lovely guy. He came in and he's delivered ditch blocking and making scrapes in the wetland, and he's done it really professionally. So we've brought another contractor, skilled up another contractor.
This story also highlights the need to be open to the unexpected in getting restoration projects done.
We have a term for it, actually. We call it field fitting. So we've got all our best laid plans, you know, and we've been there and we've measured the levels and we've gone, oh yeah, this is where the exit pipes. We've had our plan. But inevitably, when you go in, you have to think on your feet. And the contractors are only there for a set amount of time. So often they're part of that process too. And listening to the contractors and what they can and can't do with their digger is very important, I think, for restoration. Field fitting is the way forward. Essential, I think, in restoration.
In Charlotte's case, this openness to different approaches led to an unusual encounter with a traditional technique of finding underground water flows.
One of the parts of the job was that we wanted to block some clay drainage pipes that were running underneath the site. So it was an area that used to be heavily grazed, and the farmer maybe 200 years ago drained the land and disconnected it really from its floodplain. And part of that was putting in these clay drains, and they didn't come down at regular straight lines at all. So we could see the exit of the pipes in the river, but when we tracked them back, we couldn't find them again because they weren't going in a straight line. And we were wasting, you know, after a couple of hours of trying to find these drains, we didn't have the drainage maps, unfortunately. The contractor piped up that he had a specialist skill at it, that it was water divining or water dowsing, which is a technique where you get two metal rods and you hold them sort of firmly and loosely in your hand at the same time. And if you are gifted, those rods will cross when you find water. And we were all laughing about this, but the contractor said, oh, I've used this technique before, it really works. So he walked down the site, and every time his rods crossed, we put a stake in the ground, and then we brought the digger down and we started digging, and we just kept finding the clay pipes every time. which was, you know, it was a little bit of magic, really. We were all laughing about it, but it worked. It was a strange technique that we didn't foresee happening in this project that really helped us get this work done on time.
Our next story takes us to Germany to hear about a different kind of magic, where wildflower meadows are beginning to bloom along the banks of a river which was once so neglected that it became an open sewer. Nadine Gerner and her colleagues from Emscher Genossenschaft have been working to restore the Emscher River, which flows through the heavily industrialized Ruhr area in western Germany.
In the Emscher catchment, we are conducting since several decades a large-scale restoration program, bringing streams back to a near-natural state. And the Merlin project comes in here with additional measures, which are to implement flowering meadows along the streams, along the Emscher River, to enhance biodiversity, and also to use citizen science as a method to involve interested people in the area, students, pupils, just also residents that are observing the streams, to report via a groundwater app, to get an overview on water levels, high water levels, low water levels, falling dry streams, to give us an idea of the current situation.
As Nadine explains, the Emscher has been heavily altered and polluted by decades of industrial and urban development along its banks.
The Emscher area has a very long history of mining and industry. It is very densely urbanized, so the Emscher is a very challenged and strongly overused river system. Actually, the entire basin has been channelized and has been used as an open sewage system for almost a century. And since the 1990s, first of all, the sewage was diverted underground into a newly built sewage system, which has been completed just 2 years ago. And step by step, the streams were restored. The channelization was taken back where possible. The river was given space and new floodplains were attached back to the river.
Like Charlotte in Scotland, Nadine and her colleagues are working to implement nature-based solutions to help address problems with flooding in the region.
Well, currently the largest challenge in the Emscher restoration project is flood protection, because we have experienced strong flood events, especially in 2021 and again last summer in June 2023. And this latest flood event has even caused some landslides along the river Emscher. There was some erosion happening, and now, of course, there's the fear that flood protection is being challenged. And the quick answer is always to use technical measures to control the system. And with Merlin, we are trying to show that nature-based solutions can do the same, that we need to give the river space where possible to hold back water in the landscape, hold back water in floodplains, in order not to need such technical structures that control the river.
One of their eye-catching approaches is to plant wildflower meadows along the banks of the Emscher. These meadows are not only resistant to floodwaters, but they also provide vital new habitat for biodiversity.
Yeah, concerning the flowering meadows on the dikes, there's the fear that they will not be as stable as the current grass cover on the dikes. So that's what we want to show. We want to show that, for example, other case studies, they have experience with flowering meadows on dikes and they have proven that they are quite stable or equally stable or even more stable than current grass solutions. Yeah, and at the same time, enhancing biodiversity is one of the main aims, both on national basis and European basis and international basis.
This story shares themes with Arturo's from earlier. It tells us that restoration is often slow and complex, and requires patient and open communication with all stakeholders invested in a river. Moreover, though, Nadine's story highlights the need for convincing success stories of where nature-based solutions have been used in restoration to help make the case for their use in the future.
You need a long-term plan. Such nature-based solutions, they either require more space, they require a long-term planning process, they require involving different kind of stakeholders. We need to show good examples of nature-based solutions. We need to demonstrate that they work effectively. That's why we do monitoring in the Merlin project to show what are the benefits and what is the effectiveness of these nature-based solutions.
Our next story shows just how vital it is to keep strong lines of communication open with other stakeholders around a restoration site. Matea Yarak and her colleagues from WWF Adria have been working to restore the Hutovo Blato peatlands in Bosnia-Herzegovina. One of their big challenges is working with a neighbouring hydropower project, which abstracts water from the peatlands. However, last summer, water was returned to the landscape in an unexpected and disastrous way by the hydropower plant. Here's Matea to take up the story.
The site is, it's amazing. It's this beautiful, pristine wetland full of birds, some cows, not a lot of people, that's what I like. Huto Blato is wetland and it's dependent on varsity of sources of water to keep it alive, to keep it well. And the big problem that Huto Blato has is actually hydropower plant that took away a part of existing wetland and turned it into accumulation lake, and it's being used for energy production. So basically Huto Blato lost over 50% of its water that it had in past, and now it's trying to survive from the water it has from other sources like rivers or karst lakes and underground water, etc. Wetlands are naturally disappearing. It's a part of natural process. So basically what we are trying to do is slow it a bit. So our activities are clearing the channels, desilting the lakes. We are clearing some part of vegetation that is literally just like drowning the channels. So basically the whole point of the restoration activities is to bring more water in the Hutovo Blato to keep it there, mostly for preserving the peat that is there and is actually holding all the carbon inside. So basically, as I said, we are trying to keep the wetland wet. So we are trying to bring more water, but we are struggling with the hydropower taking the water from the wetland. And we are last summer, we are working, we are clearing the channels, we are having heavy machinery is there, people are there and everything. And then one day, as I said, the universe with his dark humor, he just decides to, push the brakes. Basically, the hydropower that is near flooded the whole area. So they flooded our machinery. Thankfully, there were no people there.
This sudden flash flood from water released by the hydropower plant was not communicated to the restoration team, as Matea explains.
We want to have a normal cooperation with the hydropower plant. We need them to tell us if they are going to flood us so we can prepare. And that's the basics. At one point you are doing everything to keep the water inside, and then the negative one actually floods you with no calls, no nothing. Yeah. They didn't call, they didn't put an email or anything. But the thing is that it wasn't for them. They knew they need to put the water somewhere because the downstream hydropower in Croatia, in Dubrovnik, was under reconstruction, under reparation. So they couldn't take that amount of water. But those things are known about before. So it wasn't the news for the hydropower in Hutovo. So they literally just needed to pick up the phone and tell us this is going to happen. The repercussions of that is that we had to ditch that location. That's one of the longest and biggest channels that we are clearing. But because we don't know if they will be flooding us again, we had to ditch the location and move to other parts of Blato and do other activities like the silting, etc. So this is why we need better communication and to be a partner with hydropower plants, at least a neutral one. But we cannot have them as negative stakeholders because it's useless. Then the restoration, all the hard work and all the money we put in that, it's just like useless. And we want to avoid that and try to make a nice and open conversation between us and the hydropower plant because we need each other. They need Hutovo Blato because of the water and we need them again because of the water. So now we are going to push a bit harder to get them to sit with us and start a conversation and start thinking of producing some mitigation measures, plans, just like at least a means of communication for these situations never to happen again. Because next time, I don't even want to think what would happen if there were people there.
We hear in Matea's story the importance of good communication with all the other users of a restoration site. Perhaps too, the recurring theme of how restoration begins to shift what this landscape is used for and for who, away from simply a resource for hydropower production towards a living, breathing ecosystem. This theme is also present in our final story from Romania. Iulia Poiu and her colleagues from WWF Romania have been working to restore the floodplains of Danube River in order to buffer the effects of floods and droughts exacerbated by the ongoing climate emergency.
In Romania, the Danube floodplain has, in some parts, 10 kilometers wide. During the communist regime, the floodplain was dried out to obtain land for agriculture, and dikes were constructed along the Danube. And because of this, the connection with the Danube with its floodplain was disrupted. Now, with this restoration project, we want to recreate the connection between the floodplain and the Danube. With this case study, we work on a fish farm. And using a channel from this fish farm, we bring water from Danube to its floodplain. And the surface of this, let's say, new floodplain is around 400 hectares. Why it's important to do restoration? First of all, it's important for us, for humans. Why? Because floodplains somehow protects us from floods. Then floodplains protect us from droughts. Then the floodplains are important for biodiversity. Again, are important for us, giving us space for relaxing time, giving us food, giving us wood for fire, yeah, to heat ourselves. So we can find a lot of benefits having floodplains around us.
The challenge for Iulia and her team is communicating the need to return natural processes to the floodplains, which have been drained and developed for many years. This requires making the case for floodplain restoration to both local people and politicians.
I think always is a challenge to work with humans, with people, yeah, to convince stakeholders that it's it's good to have functional floodplains around us, that it's important to give land to restore the floodplains, because to do restoration we need land. Yeah, sometimes the land is owned by the private persons and it's easier to work with them, in Romania at least, and many times the land is owned by the state, and in this case it's not so easy to work with them. So I think if we manage to convince the state, we can do restoration on a large scale. And I think we will have the chance to see the Danube floodplain as it was 60 years ago. We organize, let's say, field trips with the authorities there to show them, look, before the project here was an agricultural polder, now it's flooded and it's full, let's say, with birds. So the first result, and then we can go in the community and to have some talks there, and to understand that the community is really happy with this new wetland around them. And the community sees the benefits, full of wetlands, full of bird species, and the specific vegetation. We are talking with people along the Danube which have memories from 60 years ago. They tell us about fishing, how they used to fish in the floodplain. They tell us about the fish species, the birds, and the entire ecosystem is still in their memories.
I love this idea that a healthy ecosystem still exists in the memories of the local people who've lived and worked on this floodplain. We know that ecological restoration can't simply be a case of turning back the clock to some more diverse past, but we also need an awareness of what has been lost to provide the motivation for change. This relates to the idea of shifting baseline syndrome, the theory that suggests that each passing generation of humans accepts a less diverse, a more degraded version of the ecosystems around them. If you don't see the change before your eyes, how can you know that it's happening, let alone do something about it? As we've heard through this podcast, it's these stories of what an ecosystem has been in the past and what it might be in the future that heavily shape how restoration gets done in the present and how effective it might be. And as we heard from Arturo, for some members of the local community, it was the dams that represented the heritage of the Deba River, rather than a natural system. And here, as throughout, we see the importance of keeping lines of dialogue open with local communities and stakeholders to kickstart restoration, even when communication is difficult. In Matea's story, we see a dramatic example of what can go wrong when these lines of communication are not open and other users of the landscape don't take restoration into account. In Nadine's story, we hear about the need for compelling examples of restoration success using nature-based solutions to help make the case for their use with local stakeholders and sectors. And finally, in Charlotte's story, we hear the need to find and train up local contractors who can help make restoration a success. In this case, by using unusual traditional techniques like dowsing. Charlotte's idea of field fitting feels an apt place to end this podcast. This idea that restoration is never a simple, straightforward process runs through the stories we've heard in this podcast. Instead, it requires communication, persistence, and improvisation in equal measures. If nothing else, these stories give me hope that due to the actions of a dedicated restoration community across the continent, a healthier, more diverse future is on the horizon for Europe's fresh waters. You can find out more about the Merlin Project at project-merlin.eu. You can also keep up with progress on social media and at freshwaterblog.net. The Merlin Project is funded by the European Commission's Horizon 2020 programme. This podcast was presented and produced by me, Rob St. John, and the theme music is by project coordinator Sebastian Burke's band, Scala. The background music is by Scott Buckley. Please do like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.